Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Once upon a time, in the irrationally exuberant 1990s, there was a toy fad. All over the United States, people stocked and hoarded and traded Beanie Babies, palm-sized plush animals identifiable by their $5 retail price point and their all-important heart-shaped hang tags. They were cute enough, certainly, and probably fun to play with. But unlike earlier manias for hula hoops and Rubik's Cubes, the unprecedented demand for toy magnate Ty Warner's signature creations was driven not so much by kids wanting to play with them as by adults who came to view them as investment vehicles. The story is absurd enough in hindsight to sound almost like fiction, but we all remember the stories, right? The rush on stores by collectors waiting for new shipments to arrive, the frenzied eBay auctions of $5 toys selling for thousands of times their retail value, the guy who blew his kid's college fund buying up 20,000 Beanie Babies just before the bottom dropped out. Journalist Zach Bissonette tracked down some of those involved in the mania and traced the inflation and implosion of the market for his new book, The Great Beanie Baby Bubble, Mass Delusion and the Dark Side of Cute. Zach, welcome to Think.
Thanks so much for having me.
Ordinarily, I would start a conversation like this by asking you to explain what Beanie Babies were for those who missed the craze. But at one point, you found a significant majority of American households owned at least one of these things.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was something like 68%, according to a USA Weekend poll in 1998, which was after the McDonald's thing really drove it to this insane height that it had sort of already reached even before then. But it was 10% of eBay sales in the early days of it. There has never been a toy craze like Beanie Babies. There's never been a consumer craze like Beanie Babies. And Ty Warner, the guy who created them, became the richest man in the history of the American toy industry, which when you think about how short-lived this craze was, is pretty incredible.
It is notable that he put his profits into real estate. He wasn't dealing
with no Beanie Babies for him.
What made Beanie Babies different from other stuffed animals on the market?
So Ty himself said to employees that before Beanie Babies, he felt like there was nothing at that price point that wasn't, in his words, a piece of crap. And I think that there was a lot of truth to that. He had this really obsessive approach to product design, and particularly obsessive when it came to Beanie Babies. The head of his Canadian distributor told me this story that he remembered Ty inviting him to his office in suburban Chicago in early 1994. And reaching into his desk and pulling out a prototype for Legs the Frog and saying, from now on, every dime you have goes into this. So Ty really believed in this product. It took about 2 years for it to catch on, but once it did, it was incredible.
Yeah, this book is as much a character study as the story of a classic investment bubble. Ty Warner, interestingly, seems to have had a pretty miserable childhood and has no kids of his own.
Yeah, I mean, I remember the first time I went out to visit his mostly estranged younger sister, and she was very sort of taciturn and reluctant to say much at all, but she paused at one point and she said to me, you know, the one thing I can tell you, and I think Ty would agree with this, is that I don't think our parents loved us. And then I went and saw her again, and she gave me more of the story. But the gist is Ty Warner was born in 1944, grew up in suburban Chicago. His mother was very, very mentally ill. She was a paranoid schizophrenic, and his father was not home very much and was violent at times when he was home. And that was the environment that he grew up in.
But Ty Warner ended up going into business with his father. They both worked for the same company.
Right. So Ty went off to college after his father sent him to military school because he was kind of a juvenile delinquent. He went to Kalamazoo College for a year, majored in theater, starred in the school production of Antigone, and then dropped out and moved to California to try to become an actor, kind of. But, you know, mostly sold cameras and I think pumped gas and things like that. Finally, his father said to him, you know, you're like 20 years old. You haven't really done anything with your life. But, you know, I have a job as a salesman for Dakin, which at the time was a big plush brand, plush stuffed animals. And he said to Ty, you know, you really should come and work, you know, as my sub rep, as a salesperson for Dakin. And Ty didn't want to at first. He was very reluctant. He finally did. And once Ty entered the toy industry, it was this kind of alchemy where he had gone from, you know, someone who might have been voted, you know, least likely to succeed and kind of someone who there was no real reason to think he would amount to anything to within 2 years, the greatest toy salesman that any of the people who worked with him had ever seen. He was earning a six-figure income in the 1960s, selling, driving around in a Rolls Royce with a fur coat, selling plush animals to retailers in like Indiana and Ohio.
When the time came to start his own business, he made a really interesting choice, which was that he did not want to work with like the Walmarts and Targets and Toys R Us's of the world. He wanted to work with small retailers, independent companies.
Right. So, yeah. So the part of this was really pragmatic, which was that he didn't have a lot of cash. He had something that he inherited from his father. And if he were to sell to big accounts, they would want extended terms on payment, and they want to pay him in 30 or 90 days. I didn't have any money. He wanted to be paid COD. That was part of it. The other part of it was that he felt that it would be a safer, he wouldn't be so vulnerable to one account if he was selling to a lot of different stores. But I think the part that sort of became the most important was he wanted his pieces to have this kind of cachet, and to be in small stores, not in big stores, and to be sort of nicely displayed on shelves with you know, handwritten price tags, not dumped in bins or, you know, end caps and that kind of thing. He really, really cared about how the product was displayed. And he had his sales reps would go around, and, you know, if they didn't like the way the products were displayed, the retailer would find out about it.
There's a great story of Ty Warner and his folks at a toy convention. And, you know, they just have, I guess, booth after booth after booth. And he's there with a hairdryer, like fluffing up all of the fake animal fur on these things. Like, it was a big deal to him how they looked, went on display.
He would pluck them with tweezers at trade shows. He would blow dry them. All of his employees received very, very specific instructions on how the cats had to be displayed on the pedestal at a certain angle to maximize eye contact with the prospective buyers. There was one sales rep who remembered. I said, you know, so tell me about the first time you met Ty. And he said, oh, you know, Ty came up to me at a toy show. And he showed me this stuffed dog, and he spent like 8 minutes showing me the different ways to cock the head and kind of pantomiming with this stuffed dog. And, you know, and he said, and it was the strangest person I ever met, but I had to work for him. You know, then this was also accompanied by, you know, some other, I think, less pleasant eccentricities. Ty would instruct his employees to make sure that overweight women didn't touch the cats because he told them that they would sweat on them. And things like that. So there was this kind of cute sort of, you know, Santa's elf kind of obsessiveness with the display. And then there was a nastier, angrier side. If he didn't like the way his booth would set up, he would, you know, scream and throw just absolute tantrums and throw everything at his employees and that kind of thing.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like anybody really liked working with him or for him. But for a while, at least, they were making big money to put up with him.
Right. I mean, the sales reps were paid 10% on the retail price as a commission in the early days of the beanie craze. And some of them made millions and millions of dollars. I interviewed one woman who I think sold Beanie Babies in Minnesota to retailers in Minnesota. She made $800,000 in commissions in 1 year after having made, I think, $35,000 in commissions the year before. And a lot of the reps, which was funny, actually lost the money on internet stocks, which just goes to show that you can profit from one bubble while still being vulnerable to the kind of larger bubblicious nature of an era.
The other story I love is that at one, I guess, holiday party, he gave everybody these limited edition bears that half the employees immediately turned around and sold on eBay for the cash.
Yeah, well, he would give these billionaire bears and these number one bears at the employee functions. And at the height of the craze, it got so crazy that dealers would find out when the Thai party was going to be. And they would, like, camp out down the road from the party to try to be ready to greet the employees as they left the party to buy the bears. And then there was a whole lot. I interviewed a woman who earned a six-figure annual income doing nothing but authenticating Beanie Babies. And she would, you know, provide these certificates to certify that this was, in fact, a $5 beanbag animal. And she would charge, I think, $25 for that service. And she would camp out outside the Thai show, outside the parties, too, so that she could be ready to authenticate the employee bears.
Why were the tags such a big deal? Like keeping the tags on the little ears or whatever?
Sure. So it started out that Ty would change the design of the tag every few months and then every year or so. So the tag was a key way of dating the Beanie Baby. So, you know, a Beanie Baby with one tag you know, might be worth $5, but if you had that original tag from like the first 1994 shipment, that one might be worth $6,000. So that was how it started out, as a way to mark the rarity, and then it kind of became a fetish unto itself, where it was just such an iconic logo at the time. Everyone was familiar with it, and it was like you saw the tag, you knew that the tag was important. You know, there were people who made actually millions of dollars just selling plastic protectors to enclose the tags and protect them from age and outsiders. What was funny is I subsequently found out that some of those hang tags actually damaged the tags. So it might have been better without them.
Okay, so Ty Warner, you know, developed a good product. They were, you know, well made as kids' stuffed animals go, although that turned out not to be the big deal. He certainly took advantage of the market as it took off, but he didn't actually go into business with the Beanie Babies thinking that they would become collector's items. How did that happen?
Not at all. He went into this, his original thinking with it was that this would be a low price point item that retailers would not be able to resist, that he would sell to them, make a little bit of money with it, but really sort of open the accounts and then upsell the retailers on his bigger cats and bears and that kind of thing. And so it didn't take off for 2 years, which is kind of crucial to the way in which it did take off. So he released these in 1994, really excited about them. Nothing happened. And Ty, because of his kind of obsessive approach to product design, one of his employees remembered once he spent 9 hours on a photo shoot for a single cat. He'd stay up late into the night for hours, you know, making this first employee he had discuss how the ribbon on a cat should be tied. And that obsession didn't stop once the product had shipped. So he released Peanut the Royal Blue Elephant in 1995. And then a few months after Peanut had been released in this royal blue color, Ty decided that he would change the color to baby blue. Fast forward to early 1996, Beanie Babies were starting to take off as a popular toy in Chicago's northern suburbs. And I think more than half of the product was actually being shipped into Chicago's suburbs at the time. It was taking off as a very popular toy. And then in kind of a product of the soccer mom culture of that time, where the kind of mother-daughter connection was often centered around materialism in a way that it hadn't been historically, this collecting was overtaken by the mothers, and a relatively small group of women in Chicago became dedicated to the idea of assembling complete sets of Beanie Babies. And as they did this, they realized that pieces like Peanut the Royal Blue Elephant that Ty had changed very quickly were rare, and those started to sell for, you know, a fair amount of money among this group of women. Totally an accident. He did not intend for this to be a collectible, but it became one because those early pieces were legitimately rare because he changed the design.
And how did the word retiring come in when he would change out these designs?
This is a funny story. So this was at Toy Fair 1995, I believe. Not at Toy Fair. It was a gift show in Atlanta. And there was a Lovey the Lamb. It wasn't even a Beanie Baby. It was just a plush lamb. And they were out of stock on it because of some issue with the factory in China. And for whatever reason, buyers were really upset about this. Lovey the Lamb was really popular among hospital gift shops, and there were these salesmen for the company, the King Brothers. And other people told me this story too. But what happened was the King Brothers over lunch were talking. They're saying, gosh, you know, this Lovey the Lamb thing is really annoying because the buyers are mad at us because we don't have it, and it's creating all this tension when we tell them it's out of stock. And then one of them, remembering something at his parents' gift shop, said, well, what if instead of saying Lovey's out of stock, we start telling people Lovey's been retired? They went back after lunch, and a buyer says, you know, I wanted to buy Lovey the Lamb. And one of the King Brothers says, oh, I'm sorry, but Lovey has been retired. And the buyer said, retired? Are other pieces going to be retired? And one of the King Brothers said, well, you know, I don't know. And the buyer thought, you know, well, I better stock up in case they're going to be retired. And they told Ty about this, and boom, there was the idea to start announcing retirements of Beanie Babies.
Zach Bissonette is with us. We're talking about his new book, The Great Beanie Baby Bubble, Mass Delusion and the Dark Side of Cute. We'll be back in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering the SMU Summer Youth with hands-on workshops in robotics, Minecraft, game design, and visual arts for students entering K-12 at SMU's Plano campus. Online registration is now open at smu.edu/summeryouth.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with author Zach Bissonette. His new book is called The Great Beanie Baby Bubble, Mass Delusion and the Dark Side of Cute. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. You can email think at kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think. What sort of presence did Beanie Babies and the brand have online?
So Ty, a young employee named Lena Trevetti, who was in her early 20s and a student at DePaul University, came to Ty with an idea in late 1996 to create a website. This was before Mattel or Hasbro were really doing anything with their internet properties. And Ty asked Lena Trevetti sort of to explain to him kind of what the internet was. She brought her modem into the Ty office and showed him that there were these message boards where collectors were starting to congregate. And then Lena Trevetti, with Ty's blessing, created the website for the company, Ty.com. They spent a lot of money to get the URL from someone who had kind of who had squatted on it. And it became really the first company to aggressively use the internet to interact with consumers. There was a message board. Lena would run back and forth to the library at school to post these hourly like updates from the info beanie with rumors about what was going on at Ty and rumors about what pieces might be retired. The big turning point was on January 1st, 1997. They had announced that they would be announcing which Beanie Babies would be retired on that day. And I talked to collectors who had these vivid memories of staying up late into the night, skipping New Year's parties to just sit there reloading the computer frantically, waiting to see Kiwi the Toucan do his Shockwave, I think it was, presentation of which Beanie Babies would be retired so that they could rush online and buy them before they soared in value. And it was one of the highest traffic websites of the era.
Yeah, the timing there is also remarkable and fortunate because had this happened, you know, in like 1990, the internet wasn't sort of around in the same way that it was in the late 90s, and eBay didn't exist yet.
Right. And so not only would it it was kind of interesting on both ends. In 1990, the internet wouldn't have been around, so you couldn't do this. And by 2003, the internet and sort of e-commerce were ubiquitous enough that this wouldn't have seemed as exciting as it seemed at the time, frankly. And when I interviewed people who had gotten caught up in that, that was one of the things that really jumped out to me was the newness of like trading with people online and the newness of like peer-to-peer e-commerce and message boards and all that kind of thing created this kind of a rush of adrenaline and excitement with swapping Beanie Babies that hadn't existed, that I think would not have existed at any other time other than the early days of the mass adoption of the internet. But yeah, it was 10% of eBay sales in the early days. eBay disclosed in the risk factors section of its SEC filings its dependency on the Beanie Baby market. Wall Street analysts worried that if Beanie Babies went down in sort of interest, that eBay's results would suffer. eBay, and Meg Whitman has said this, eBay was kind of built on the backs of Beanie Babies.
And, you know, I was actually looking this morning to see if they were still being traded, and sure enough, they are. And people are still trying to pass off, you know, rare Princess Diana bear, $120. I guess some kind of market still exists?
Yeah, but the Princess Diana one's not worth anything. Those people are crazy. I always see those listings, and I wonder what is going on with that. But no, I mean, probably, you know, maybe 0.1% of the Beanie Babies that were sold, the really rare early ones, like Peanut the Royal Blue Elephant, are still worth a few $100s. I think Peanut, that early elephant who was the subject of a great Dave Barry column mocking the demand for Peanut the Royal Blue Elephant, I think are valuable as much as cultural artifacts of this mania as anything else. I mean, they really capture this weird sort of go-go period in American history.
So I was like born without the gene that makes you want to collect things, but I know lots of people. Yeah, I'm not really a collector, but I know people get into things. But typically, the people I know that collect something specific, it's really linked to a personal interest, right? They're interested in maps, or they're interested in old books, or coins, or pens, or something. These things. I mean, how did so many people suddenly want to collect these all at the same time? It can't be that many like adult men and women suddenly cared for small stuffed animals.
I think in some way it was kind of a massive psychotic flashback to the comfort that stuffed animals provided in our early years for most of us. I think that was a small piece of it. I think the really large piece of it was these stories that were spreading about how much people were making with them. Because, I mean, with Beanie Babies, as best I can estimate, probably about 70% of the demand by 1998, 1999 was from adult speculators, not sort of children or sort of people who wanted them. It was from people who thought they were going to get rich. And it was the stories of a speculative mania in Beanie Babies and people making money. It started out with a very small group of people, but the story spread it. There was, you know, a big piece in the Wall Street Journal about a middle school student who had made millions of dollars with a website selling Beanie Babies. You know, there were stories, you know, in the Chicago Tribune about people who were, you know, paying for college or had bought cars or in some cases houses with Beanie Babies. There was a price guide, a self-published price guide that predicted what each animal would be worth 10 years later. That sold 4 million copies. So really, I think it was spread and people were lured into it by the sort of gambler's excitement and the get-rich-quick aspect of it.
The thing that struck me when this was going on was that Ty Warner never said how many of these things he had stocked away, and he could have at any moment re-released any of these things. How did that not occur to people who were paying hundreds and even thousands of dollars for a $5 toy?
So this is kind of one of the pieces where his distribution strategy. So the head buyer for Toys R Us remembered, for Toys R Us's plush department, remembered just calling Ty's office over and over again trying to get product, and Ty would not sell to them. The CEO of one of the big specialty toy chains, one of the little chains that Ty would sell to because their stores were sort of high end, remembered that he would fly to Chicago and camp out, you know, just wait in Ty's, like, reception area to beg him for product. That was how important it was to the retailers. But because Ty was selling through such a large network of tiny retailers, people never saw these things in huge boxes or stacks. So Ty decided that he would limit every store to 36 of each style per month. Hmm. So you would never go in and see a bin of, like, Kiwi the Toucan. You would just see, like, four or five of them. What people didn't know was that he was selling to tens of thousands of stores. Huh. But you didn't see it. You just saw the one you were in your town. And so I think a huge part of it was it was the sort of diffuse distribution.
Why did he decide to strike a deal with McDonald's when he had worked so hard to make this like a boutique product?
He was really ambivalent about this. People who had worked on that remembered pursuing him for months to even get him to talk to them. Basically, this also ties in with the distribution thing. Because he was selling through sort of gift shops and specialty toy stores and that kind of thing, he didn't have great penetration in like urban areas or among low-income families and that kind of thing. In the beginning, it really started out as kind of a middle and upper middle class soccer mom thing. And he felt that by getting a small version of them in the McDonald's Happy Meals, it would get the brand and the product in front of consumers who didn't normally go to these specialty stores and drive them into the stores. That was the thinking behind it.
And McDonald's was instantly overwhelmed.
It was crazy. There was a former spokesman for McDonald's. She told me that to this day, she said, when she sees her colleagues, all she has to do is say, teeny beanies. And they go, oh, just shoot me. But what was kind of weird about the McDonald's thing kind of marked this turning point. You know, where the sales went up, I think, about fivefold after the McDonald's thing, after already being enormous. They went, you know, from enormous to, like, the largest thing ever. It was kind of a turning point in the beginning of this really dark phase where it just became, you know, there was one of the early collectors said to me that she remembered how much fun these had been in the beginning, how comforting they were. And then she said, you know, and then it just became about greed. And the story I love that illustrates this is that McDonald's was introduced to Beanie Babies because a psychotherapist who did a support group for children who had parents who had cancer used them in the group as kind of a comfort object, for a transitional object for these kids in this support group. And McDonald's was funding that program. And someone from McDonald's sat in on this group one day and saw how much the kids in the group loved the Beanie Babies. And that was how this came to McDonald's attention. After the McDonald's craze happened, and I tracked down and interviewed this psychotherapist, she remembered the most kind of disturbing thing happened, which was that at the end of every sort of 12-week session, she would let each kid take home a Beanie Baby. After the McDonald's thing drove it crazy, she remembered that she would get to the last day of the session, and kids would come in with, you know, oh, my mom said I have to get Humphrey the Camel because he's going to be worth a lot of money. And another kid would say, no, my dad said I have to get Humphrey the Camel. And so she had to stop using them in the therapy group with kids whose parents were dying of cancer because the speculative element and the greed had taken over to the point where these things that had been designed for children were now, you literally couldn't give them to children without causing problems.
And these parents dying of cancer said, listen, if nothing else happens right this week, you get Humphrey the Camel.
Yeah, there were some really sad stories that I came across of, you know, of a woman who had, I think, a son who was severely disabled. And she was saying, you know, that she hadn't paid the she had written this in a magazine at the time, and she hadn't paid the mortgage in months, but she was buying Beanie Babies, and she just felt that, you know, at least this way he'll have something that he can, you know, use to support himself. It got really dark, really awful, really messed up.
Tell us about this poor guy who once had a job on, what was it, General Hospital, and hadn't worked so much in recent years, but thought, I'm going to invest what money I do have buying 20,000 Beanie Babies.
Yes, he was in a store in Boston with his son and bought a Beanie Baby, and someone told him that these were an investment and that some of them were worth a lot of money. And he bought the price guides and saw the books, and there was a million copy a month magazine that was a price guide to Beanie Babies. And he just really bought into this hook, line, and sinker. And pretty soon he had, you know, drafted his kids and his wife at the time.
Operative into, phrase.
Into every weekend they were at Hallmark stores lining up, pretending not to know each other to get around the per family limits on Beanie Babies. And he spent an amount, I think, in the low six figures, and he still has them, and they're not worth anything.
So Ty Warner's warehouses occasionally would be full of beanies that had been retired, and it got to be such an issue that at one point they had to, like, invest in a machine to rip these perfectly good things apart so that there wouldn't be too many of them out.
Yeah, this is a little bit. But so Ty's girlfriend, when he started the company in the 80s, was Patricia Roach. And she kind of worked with him. They had this epic breakup where he caught her with another guy in Cancun. He'd flown there to catch her. And then they split up, and she became the distributor for Ty UK and made tens of millions of dollars with it. But one of the things Ty would do, she says, to kind of mess with her is he would ship her, you know, 10,000 Beanie Babies and then call her while they were en route and say, oh, I'm retiring that one so you can't sell it, but you still have to pay me for it. And she would say, well, Ty, if you're charging me for them, they're not retired in England. And then he'd say, well, then I'll just stop shipping you Beanie Babies and you won't make any money. So very reluctantly, she had to spend, I think, $10,000 or something on this machine that would rip apart the Beanie Babies and discard the fabrics, and then they could sell the pellets back to the factories in China.
His personal life seems like a mess, and largely because of choices that he has made. He's like this weird William Randolph Hearst recluse.
Yeah, I think that's a good description. He has a $150 million mansion in Montecito, California. If you're ever in Montecito, you should go walk around the outskirts of it. It has a, you know, wall and lots of vegetation, so it's hard to see much. But yeah, he owns the Four Seasons Hotel in New York, which he recently turned down, I think, a $950 million offer for. But he has never been married, no kids. And kind of the reporting on the book had this very sad element to it, because in reporting on his life, it was really you know, tracking down a lot of people whose relationships with him had not ended well. And there's a group of Thai employees that still get together every few years. And without fail, the topic of conversation is always, you know, for all that money, I wouldn't trade places with Thai.
Hmm. He wouldn't talk to you for the book. Is that right?
I talked to him. He was at Toy Fair. I knew he was going to be there. I knew when he was going to be there. So I went and waited for him. And I approached him and told him I was doing this book. You know, and I said, I know that you historically haven't talked to reporters, but, you know, I think you have one of the most incredible entrepreneurial success stories in American history, how you turned nothing but these beanbag animals into one of the largest fortunes in America, and I hope you'll tell your story to me. And he said, the Beanie Babies, it was a lot of good and a lot of bad. And he said, and if I tell you a story, I would just tell you the good, and then it wouldn't be balanced. And I said, well, Mr. Warner, I appreciate that, but, you know, I could talk to other people, too, to get the other side. And then he said, I think it's better if you just talk to other people. And that was the last time I talked to him. I followed up with his office, but I didn't get an interview. But I don't think it suffered. And I think in a way he's interesting sort of from that slight remove, because I got, you know, ex-girlfriends, so many ex-employees, his sister, people who went to high school with him, people who went to college with him, to really, I think, fill out the portrait of him.
His sister has had financial problems over the years, which yes. seems surprising given the amount of wealth that he has.
Yeah, I mean, it's very sad. She had asked him for $1,000 to pay for hip surgery, I think a deductible on it, and he texted back, no. Yeah, so it's that's not a good relationship, and I never quite understood what happened there. I mean, I think the gist of it is, you know, most people's experience with Ty was not that he was generous.
Is he? He's involved right now in is it prosecution by the government or is it a lawsuit for some unpaid taxes?
No, he pleaded guilty to a felony for the largest Swiss bank tax evasion case in U.S. history. He had over $100 million in a Swiss bank account. He pleaded guilty. The guidelines were for 4 to 5 years in prison, but he was able to get community service. But the government felt that sentence was so light that it appealed it, and that appeal is still ongoing. So there is still a chance that he will end up in prison at 70 years old.
Describe for us the terms of his community service.
This is interesting. He is helping entrepreneurs clubs at a couple inner city Chicago schools to design their own plush products for school fundraisers and kind of learn about business. And I've spent some time talking with the principal at one of these schools who has said that Ty has just been incredible with the kids, that he's like generous with his time. The kids really like him. They aren't put off by the fact that he's very rich. And, you know, that he comes in and you know, they'll ask him questions. Like one of them said, you know, how'd you come up with the idea for Beanie Babies? And Ty said, I tried to think like a kid. And he, you know, asked the kids to draw their own designs for pieces. And Ty kind of walked around the room and critiqued the designs. And one kid was working on a design for a V-neck sweater. And Ty was saying, you know, well, you should think about when you're designing it. Is that for like a parent or a grandparent? The most important thing with product is to always keep in mind who your customer is. And then Ty collected the drawings. And a few months later, he came back for his next meeting with them. And he had prototypes made at his – he had taken them himself and had – Ty is still at the factories in China for months every year working on new Beanie Babies. And he had these beautiful designs made based on the students' designs. And the principal said just how excited the kids were, you know, to see the – he called it the fruit of their labors, you know, these things that they had designed. And Ty Warner, the billionaire, had gone and done it.
My guest is author Zach Bissonnette. His new book is called The Great Beanie Baby Bubble, Mass Delusion and the Dark Side of Cute. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering the SMU Summer Youth with hands-on workshops in robotics, Minecraft, game design, and visual arts for students entering K-12 at SMU's Plano campus. Online registration is now open at smu.edu/summeryouth.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with author Zach Bissonnette about his new book, The Great Beanie Baby Bubble, Mass Delusion and the Dark Side of Cute. You can send email to think@kera.org, send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think, or you can call to join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. Zach, how did the bottom fall out of the Beanie Baby market?
I think as Ernest Hemingway wrote of going bankrupt two ways, gradually and then suddenly. I mean, the reason that it fell out, you know, was that it was stupid and destined to end, as all bubbles are. The longer, more complicated answer is probably a little more than we have time for. But the gist is that at the beginning of 1999, so the sort of calculus and alchemy of Beanie Babies had always been that if you bought them before they were retired, then waited until they were retired, they instantly went up in value and you could sell them and make money. And it was the stories of people doing that kept this thing going and the belief. And it became a really widespread belief. Oh, yeah, retire Beanie Babies, good as gold. They go up in value. At the end of 1998, Ty retires a bunch of Beanie Babies, announcing that they'll be retired at the end of the year. January 1st comes, and all of a sudden, for the first time, they don't go up in value. And Mary Beth Sabaluski, the editor of the million-copy-a-month Beanie Baby magazine, remembered being in an airport. She was traveling, I think, to speak at a Beanie Baby convention and seeing just stacks of retired Beanie Babies still available for $5 each. And once people realized that it wasn't a law of physics that retired Beanie Babies went up in value, it was the beginning of the end. And the salespeople who were earning $800,000 in 1998 and 1999 by the early 2000s were no longer earning a living wage. I mean, it just imploded. And they all ended up worthless.
And there are, you know, like I'll drive through my neighborhood and see, you know, a Rubbermaid tub full of these things at a garage sale. But there are also people who have held on to them and continue to sort of believe that the market's coming back.
Yeah, you do find that. Everyone on Craigslist, you'll see ads where someone will have, you know, very specific prices for each one. This one's 7, this one's 12, this one's 18. It's like they're all worth a quarter. but yeah, and I spent some time with a guy in North Carolina who has 40,000 of them. They're like his obsession, and he thinks he'll one day build a museum to Beanie Babies. So it is not what it was, but there still are believers.
And this is the guy who lives with his daughter, and there's sort of a strange, they're both obsessed with Beanie Babies.
Yes. Yeah. That's all I'll say about that.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone to Yolanda in Ennis. Hi, Yolanda.
Hello. I was just going to say that when I first heard about the Beanie Babies and I saw these people collecting them, I couldn't see how there could possibly be any value in it. There were too many of them that were too mass-produced and too many people had them. And that was my opinion from the very beginning. And I just couldn't get... I mean, I bought a few for children and things like that, and I buy them at thrift stores when I see them. And I see them sometimes where they've gone up to $5 or something, but I could just never... It just never looked like to me there were just too many of them out there to possibly ever be valuable. Why couldn't other people see that?
Well, because other people are not as smart as you.
But it is a classic bubble, right? I mean, this is not so different from real estate. It's not so different from anything else that gets artificially inflated.
Yeah, I think it was the stories of all the people I know who got super into them were driven by stories of how much money other people were making. I really, really think it was the stories.
And I suppose people get that sense that they're getting in sort of late, so they have to make up for lost time, and that drives up the market such as it is, at least temporarily.
Yes. Yeah, so, well, it was people backtracking to get the ones that had already been retired. Exactly. And that was part of – it's kind of this naturally occurring Ponzi scheme element to it, where as long as there are new collectors entering and they need to go back and get all the retired pieces – then you can still have a market. But once you don't have sort of a new influx of investors coming in, you just don't have anything, you know, there's no demand sort of coming in to drive prices up.
Did you meet people who remembered owning these things as a kid but not being allowed to play with them?
Yes.
That's so sad to me.
Yes, no, there's a sad element to it. The nice thing, though, now is that now that they're all worthless, people donate them to police stations and that kind of thing. And a lot of police departments keep them in the back of their cruisers. So it all goes full circle.
To give to a kid who's been traumatized in some way.
Yes, exactly.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next to Nicole in Dallas. Hello, Nicole.
Hi there. I just had a little piece of trivia that I learned recently at the Dallas Museum of Art. The museum recently acquired the largest piece of silver work created by the Wiener Werkstatt. It's called the Wittgenstein Vitrine, and it's probably 5 or 6 feet tall with pearls and all this incredible silver work. And at the seminar about the piece, we were told that the last private owner allowed his child to store her Beanie Babies in it. And if you could see this piece, if you go to the Dallas Museum of Art website, you'll be able to find the Wittgenstein Vitrine. And if you take a look at it, you just won't even believe that somebody let their kid put Beanie Babies in it.
That is fantastic. I have to Google that as soon as I get off.
Definitely.
Here.
You'll get a kick out of it.
Awesome. Thank you for telling us that. That is wonderful. You made my day.
Did you collect these? Are you young enough to have had a collection of Beanie Babies?
I didn't really. I had a few. I don't. But what I do remember is I collected lots. I went to flea markets and yard sales a lot with my mother. I grew up on Cape Cod, Massachusetts. And I remember going to this Dick and Ellie's flea market. And, no one knew what Beanie Babies were. And then all of a sudden, it was like dominated by Beanie Babies. And like easily 20% of the dealers were these Beanie Baby aficionados with fanny packs and talking excitedly about the rising prices. And then, that lasted about a year and a half, and then they were gone and no one ever talked about it again.
What does this teach us, do you think, this story about spotting economic bubbles in other industries? I mean, like, could you apply this to something like Bitcoin?
I think what it makes me nervous of with things like Bitcoin is when people, you know, don't seem to be driven by any underlying fundamentals that you can discern, where the interest in something is really being driven by excitement about how much other people are making and how much something's gone up in value, kind of momentum investing, basically. It makes me nervous when it's the stories about how much things have gone up in value that is bringing in investors, you know, as opposed to, you know, with housing, you know, well, oh, I need a place to live, so I'll buy a house, you know, or something like that. When it becomes people being driven by past returns, that's when I get nervous and think of Beanie Babies.
Yeah, and I suppose any time that, and I'm not implying that Bitcoin is a bubble. I honestly don't
know.
No,
me neither.
But, you know, whenever you get to the point that people assume that you can't go wrong, that's when you know something's going to go wrong.
Yeah, it's as good as cash. No, cash is as good as cash.
There were times when people, like couples, were splitting up and they had to decide how to, like, divide up their Beanie Baby collection.
Yeah, there was a couple that had to divide them on the floor of a court. Under the supervision of a judge and a bailiff, they had to, like, do a draft. And Maple the bear, who was a special bear who was released only in Canada, was the first one drafted in that. Then there was another really weird story in Iowa with a guy who was upset about the size of his wife's Beanie Baby collection, I think among other things. And so he decided to take her Beanie Babies out into the yard and set them on fire to sort of teach her a lesson about buying stupid things and doing stupid things with money. And as he later put it in a deposition, it flared up a lot faster than I thought it was going to, unquote, and he burned down his house.
Hmm. Were there counterfeit Beanie Babies at the height of this?
Yeah, a lot. It was actually a big issue and something Ty was, you know, litigating against very aggressively and Customs was involved in. The U.S.'s trade ambassador, actually, on a trip back from China, was stopped at the border and had her Beanie Babies confiscated because Ty had gotten these import restrictions placed on them because a lot of counterfeit Beanie Babies were coming in through the sort of gray market from China. And some Republican congressman released a statement excoriating the trade ambassador, and he said, you know, that at a time when we should be dealing with our record trade deficit, you know, our own trade ambassador is in China, you know, buying up every black market Beanie Baby she can find.
It does seem, I mean, in some ways it's, I mean, I'm not encouraging people to do things that are dishonest, but, you know, when you're trying to counterfeit like an expensive watch or a handbag, at some point the materials get expensive, but making these things, I mean, it seems like a good idea
nice
for a bad
guy.
Nice
work if you get it. No, totally. I mean, and it was, you know, the collectors who don't want to admit that they participated in something stupid will tell you that it was counterfeiting that destroyed the Beanie Baby market. There are absolutely people who to this day will sit surrounded, as I spend time with them, who will sit surrounded by their Beanie Babies and will tell you that if it hadn't been for those counterfeits, this would still be going.
Wow. I guess another reason that the bottom dropped out and that the bubble burst was that everybody was collecting them to hold them and sell them, right? At some point, there's just a glut on the market
right.
of pristine
condition. There's a saying in the antiques business that, you know, if everyone saved everything, nothing would be worth anything. And so, you know, the things it's, you know, my dad saved his baseball cards from the 1950s and they were worth a lot of money, I think $15,000 or something. But they're only worth that because very, very few people were obsessive compulsive enough to save their baseball cards in mint condition back then. And that's the problem with Beanie Babies. People ask me if they'll ever make a comeback and the answer is no, because there are just too many of them preserved in mint condition.
Do you think they were, I mean, I know Ty has come back and tried to do other products, Ty Warner, that haven't been as successful. Can you tell the story of the, what were they called, the little dolls that looked like humans or weird-looking humans?
Oh, the Beanie Kids?
Yeah.
Oh, this was funny. So one of the gimmicks that Ty, he announced that he was going to retire all the Beanie Babies at the end of 1999, and he called his ex-girlfriend, who was then running Ty UK, and he told her, you know, Patty, I'm going to retire all the Beanie Babies and replace them with Beanie Kids, which were these hideous looking. I think that's a relatively objective thing to say. Sort of beanie children that had like receding hairlines and just looked awful. And Patty said to him, Ty, they're ugly. And he said, they'll buy it, Patricia. I could put the Ty heart on manure and they'd buy it. And Ty had, I think, by that point, weirdly fallen under the spell of his own little bubble and for a very brief period, I think, abandoned his commitment to the quality of the product. And he, the Beanie Kids were a disastrous flop, and he has now very successful again. It's, he's the number one plush brand in the world again. It's, the sales are not what they were, and he is obsessed with the product again.
And for a while, there were Sasha and Malia Beanie Kids?
That was very, those were Thai girls. He decided that he would release these two Thai girls named Sasha and Malia to coincide with the inauguration. And the Michelle Obama's spokesperson weirdly criticized it and said that it was inappropriate, you know, for them to be doing that. And then Thai, through a spokesperson, said that, you know, they could, the company couldn't say whether the dolls had been named after Sasha and Malia Obama, that their naming process was proprietary. But they then pulled the dolls, and for a very, very brief moment, Thai fever was rekindled, and they sold for a few hundred dollars on eBay.
You know, kids aren't playing with as many toys as they used to because so much is electronic now. I mean, a lot of kids over, I don't know, 6 or 7 just wouldn't be caught dead with a doll.
Yeah, no, a lot of toy industry executives I interviewed complained about that, that, you know, it used to be that the target market for a plush product was, you know, boys and girls aged, you know, birth to like 9 at one time. Now you're lucky if it's birth to age 5.
Hmm.
It's kind of sad.
So is Ty still actively, you said he's still going to the factories. I mean,
still at the factories. No, I had talked to someone a few months ago who was telling me that he had kept rejecting eye samples for the new Beanie Booze, his line of, they have these big eyes, and he kept having them send him the samples for the eyes, and he was saying, not good enough, send me more, send me more. He went through like 12 of them or something. So he is still, and it's funny because it can't possibly be about the money at this point, because the overwhelming majority of his fortune at this point is in his real estate holdings, but the plush business is where his heart is.
Any idea, without any heirs, where he will put his money when he dies?
That is the mystery. And it was, I had been told this by different people that, you know, Ty didn't have a will. And one executive told me that he once asked Ty's lawyer, you know, what about Ty's estate planning? And the lawyer said to him, that is a question that cannot be asked. And then it came out in the course of his of the legal filings over his tax case that he, in fact, does not have a will. So, you know, if he dies intestate, as it's known, his sole heir would appear to be his sister.
Do you have, well, that would, I suppose, be the ultimate revenge for her. Do you have a favorite Beanie Baby? Like, is there one now on your computer just because of this project?
I have multiple favorites. I would have to go with Kaleidoscope, who everyone who's listening has to Google Kaleidoscope Beanie Baby. It came out, I want to say, in 2001, 2002. It was after the height of it, but it was this beautiful, multicolored sort of tie-dyed. It was just a beautiful piece. It's like a sculpture.
Wow. And what's it what's it worth on eBay?
$1.
The new book by journalist Zach Bissonette is called The Great Beanie Baby Bubble, Mass Delusion and the Dark Side of Cute. Zach, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Thanks. This was fun.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered today by Alan Roberts. Lindsay Connect is associate producer with help on the phones from Celine Alba. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think, and you can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.